you know, Taiwan is not going to magically like one day kind of think, oh yeah, maybe unification is a good idea.
It's a good idea.
Right? There's you know, overwhelming sentiment among Taiwan's population kind of across the political spectrum that, you know, regardless of kind of what you think about unification as kind of an aspirational long-term goal, that unification with the PRC is not a good idea.
Liberal halvtime. En podcast fra tankesmien Civita.
Welcome to Liberal halvtime. My name is Matilda Fasting, and today I'm joined by Scott Kastner, who is a professor in the Department of Government and Politics of University of Maryland, College Park. This is a podcast in my Nobel Symposium series this summer on politics and economics in China and Southeast Asia. Today we're going to talk about China and Taiwan. Kastner's research focuses on the international policies of East Asia, and he teaches classes on international relations, U.S.-China relations, international political economy, and East Asia. He is the author of several books, China, Strategic Multilateralism, Investing in Global Governance, that is with Margaret Person and Chad Rector at the Cambridge University Press from 2019, and also the book Political Conflict and Economic Interdependence Across the Taiwan Strait and Beyond. And that's Stanford University Press from 2009. So it's a very big pleasure for me to welcome you today, Scott. Thanks for joining.
Thank you for having me.
I think we can start with the outlining the Taiwan history since 1949. We have different things that has happened, and I'm sure that our listeners are keen on knowing what are the exact things that has happened, and then also probably trying to explain to us the historical origins of the dispute that we now know that are between China and Taiwan and the Taiwan Strait.
Sure. So I think maybe it makes sense to just kind of begin by noting that Taiwan had been incorporated into China kind of way back in the 17th century, formally as part of the Qing Empire, which was the last of the imperial dynasties governing China. And the Qing ultimately ended up losing a war to Japan shortly before they collapsed in the late 19th century. And Taiwan was ceded to Japan, and so it became a Japanese colony for about 50 years. At the end of World War II, in 1945, it was returned to Chinese sovereignty, but at this point, the Qing was long gone, and so you had a Republic of China, and so it kind of formally became part of the Republic of China in 1945. And then in the late 1940s, you have civil war in China, and of course, ultimately, the Chinese Communist Party prevailed and set up the People's Republic of China on mainland China. And the losing party in the civil war, the Nationalists, led by Chiang Kai-shek, retreated to Taiwan at the end of the Civil War, along with their government, the Republic of China. And so since 1949, you've had kind of two separate governments. You've had a People's Republic of China on the mainland, a Republic of China on Taiwan. Chiang Kai-shek did not see himself as the leader of Taiwan. He saw himself as the rightful ruler of China. He viewed the Republic of China as the rightful government of all of China, and he viewed the People's Republic as an utterly illegitimate regime. And so his goal was to figure out a way to reestablish Republic of China governance over all of China. The PRC, for its part, kind of viewed Taiwan as unfinished business from the Civil War and kind of viewed Taiwan as kind of the last piece of China that needed to be liberated from the Nationalists, like the rest of China had been from the Chinese Communist Party's perspective. So in the decades after 1949, you basically kind of had this conflict between the two sides that was kind of centered on which government was the rightful government of China. Was it the Republic of China government on Taiwan led by the Nationalists and Chiang Kai-shek, or was it the People's Republic of China on the mainland? Both view Taiwan as part of China, and both view the other regime as kind of utterly illegitimate. And so this kind of persisted for a number of decades, and Taiwan was governed in a very authoritarian fashion under martial law until the 1980s, and it really wasn't possible to kind of openly speak out against this kind of orthodoxy of the Zhang regime, right? This being the rightful government of all of China and kind of the ultimate goal being unification under the ROC. But in the 1980s into the 1990s, you had democratization in Taiwan. And so you started to have kind of alternative viewpoints that could be expressed more freely. You had opposition parties develop, including the Democratic Progressive Party, which became kind of the main opposition party in Taiwan at the time. And by the 1990s, the Democratic Progressive Party kind of openly embraced Taiwan independence as a policy goal. And the current president in Taiwan, Tsai Ing-wen, is of the Democratic Progressive Party. And she's, I think, rightly kind of thought of as a moderate in her approach to relations across the Taiwan Strait. She hasn't done anything dramatic like declare independence or anything like this. But she doesn't embrace this idea that Taiwan should be thought of as a part of China. And the PRC refuses to engage in dialogue with her as a result. And we've seen kind of this ratcheting up of tension in the Taiwan Strait in recent years. So whereas kind of early on in the years after 1949, this is really a dispute between kind of which government is the rightful government of all of China, the PRC or the ROC. In more recent years, I think it makes more sense to kind of think of the dispute as involving whether Taiwan should be thought of as part of China at all.
Yeah, and what you're saying also is that from the 1980s and onwards, the political development in those two parts of China, so to say, Taiwan and China mainland, that has been really, really very, very different.
Yes, yeah. So whereas in Taiwan, right? So you go back into the early 80s, right? Taiwan was still quite authoritarian, right? Opposition parties were not allowed. Martial law was in effect. But beginning in the late 1980s, you really had this process of rapid democratization. So by 1996, you have direct presidential elections, Taiwan is generally seen as a very vibrant democracy today, very much in contrast to the PRC, of course.
Do you think that makes it more difficult to see, as you said, a dialogue between those two countries because of this very different political development?
Well, so I think it's worth noting that actually kind of the period of time when you had kind of the most stable relations in recent decades, when there was kind of this period of detente from 2008 to 2016, Taiwan was very much democratic during this period of time. It was just that the nationalists had won the presidency, and it kind of embraced a version of kind of a one-China principle, like not embracing unification in the near term by any means, but embracing this idea that in principle, Taiwan could be thought of as Chinese, right? And so during this time, you had dialogue, you had a raft of agreements, mostly on kind of functional issues being reached between the two sides. So I don't think it's out of the question, right? Especially if the nationalists prevail in Taiwan, that you can have some stability and dialogue and agreements being reached. But certainly the fact that there's such divergence politically makes it much more difficult to imagine kind of some sort of resolution to the kind of underlying issue, just because people in Taiwan, I think, are rightfully very proud of their democracy, and they worry about what it would look like if you saw anything kind of resembling unification with the PRC.
And apart from the political divergence, how are the economic relations between China and Taiwan, like dependencies, exports, imports, etc.? How much communication is there actually in those areas?
Yeah, so the cross-Taiwan Strait relationship is kind of interesting in that even as you saw this kind of deepening political divergence in the 1990s and 2000s, there's at the same time, there's kind of rapid economic integration across the Taiwan Strait. And so mainland China is by far Taiwan's kind of primary trading partner. It replaced the United States in that regard back in the early 2000s. The vast kind of bulk of Taiwan's outbound investment over the past few decades has flowed to mainland China. Many Taiwanese companies basically moved their production facilities over to mainland China. So you have Taiwanese companies like Foxconn, which basically manufactures Apple products in China, right? But it's a Taiwanese company, but all their manufacturing pretty much is in China. So the Taiwan economy is quite dependent on this relationship. But I think it should be noted that the PRC gets a lot economically out of it as well, not only in terms of all the kind of investment that's come in and the know-how, but Taiwan provides kind of a lot of kind of very high-end component parts. So Taiwan, for instance, is kind of one of the world's leading producers of very high-end semiconductors. So China and indeed kind of the world economy in general are quite kind of dependent on, some stuff that's being produced in Taiwan. Mm-hmm.
So it's not like little brother, big brother. It's actually a little bit more equal.
I think it's a little bit more equal. So even though there's a huge size discrepancy, right? And so obviously the you know, in terms of population, China's 1.4 billion, Taiwan's about 23 million. So it's not even, you know, same ballpark. But, and so the Taiwan economy as a whole, right, like cross-strait ties are a much greater percentage of economic output in Taiwan. But China gets a lot out of it, certainly.
So, well, this shows this historical development and also the economic relations shows that it's really, there are ties between these two countries. But let's go to the question about war in the Taiwan Strait, because I think people here in Norway and listeners, they will right now think about Taiwan and China just in this, with these lenses on. And starting with China trying to occupy Taiwan, for instance, as you said, they're much bigger. They are many, many more people, and it's you can't compare that really. How likely is this scenario, you think?
So it's certainly something that people have started to worry a lot more about in recent years, owing in large part not only to the size discrepancy, but the fact that we've seen so much economic development and dynamism in China and the consequent kind of ability to invest heavily in very rapid military modernization, which has really kind of changed the game in terms of the balance of military power in the Taiwan Strait. So it's something that's not out of the question, I think, in to the same degree that it was, you know, just, you know, a decade ago, people really tended to discount kind of the feasibility of an invasion and occupation kind of scenario, just because logistically it's so difficult to mount an invasion across, you know, 100 miles of water and try to occupy, you know, a piece of territory where you probably have a hostile population. So it's something that's less unimaginable, I think, than it was in the past. And people are starting to kind of worry more about it, especially kind of looking forward if these kind of trends in terms of the balance of power continue. But that said, I don't think that Beijing is eager to start a war in the Taiwan Strait right now, because it's still something that would be an enormously risky gambit for the PRC. It's not clear that it would succeed, I think, even with the disparities, just because of the logistical challenges. It's possible that the United States could intervene, right, which could really ratchet up the risk to the PRC. And just beyond kind of the possibility of military complications or failure is just kind of the enormous potential economic consequences of a serious conflict in the Taiwan Strait, which could really put a damper on a Chinese economy that's already experiencing a number of pretty significant challenges that I think some of your other the people that you're interviewing in your podcast are going to discuss a little bit. So I don't think of it as something that's highly likely in the near term, but it's something that I think increasingly can't be discounted in the way that maybe it was in the not too distant past.
Because in your Nobel talk, you outlined a couple of scenarios, both for Taiwan and for China, and what could actually lead to armed conflict. Because when you start talking about things, you should think about different scenarios and also different factors that could be more or less risky if they develop. So you have a couple of them, and what are they?
Yeah, so one is kind of the scenario that we just talked about, right? So it's kind of the possibility that the PRC invades and occupies Taiwan, right, to accomplish this goal that it's had for you know, going back to 1949, right, finishing the Civil War, essentially, and reunifying Taiwan with the rest of the country. And certainly that's something that, you know, is becoming more feasible in a way that it wasn't in the not-too-distant past as a consequence largely of the shifting balance of military power in the region. This is a scenario that I think largely would occur in the context of a China that's becoming very confident, right, in its ability to succeed in this kind of endeavor, which, you know, carries a lot of downside risks. And it's one that I don't think would happen unless Beijing were very confident, right, that it could pull it off at acceptable cost to kind of the broader goals of kind of continued economic development and, you know, what Xi Jinping kind of refers to as the rejuvenation of China. Another scenario, though, is one that's, I think, kind of occurs in the context of a China that's kind of more pessimistic and kind of worried about where things are going in the Taiwan Strait, right? And it's more kind of reactive, right? Not taking the initiative to accomplish reunification, but more kind of acting to prevent Taiwan's separation from China. Right, something that if the PRC kind of becomes convinced that the PRC that Taiwan's kind of moving in a direction of kind of making its separation from China something that would essentially be permanent, right? And so you could imagine, so in the past, in the 90s and 2000s, people often, as Taiwan was democratizing, people often worried about a Taiwan that might do something dramatic, like declare its independence, right? Declare the establishment of an independent Republic of Taiwan and do away with the Republic of China, right?
That would be dangerous.
That would be dangerous, yes. Because the PRC has been very consistent for decades, right? That it views this as a cause for war, right? And I think is very the PRC is very credible in this regard. They've passed laws. They've issued any number of statements, right? Just kind of emphasizing that Taiwan independence is a cause for war, and we don't care how we'll pay any price, right? In the context of to prevent Taiwan independence, I think that kind of dramatic scenario has become less likely, just because China clearly, even if invading and occupying Taiwan is logistically difficult, China can easily impose a range of costs on Taiwan, right? And Taiwan is very vulnerable to things like PRC missile attacks, airstrikes, possible embargo, right? And, economic sanctions, right? And so the PRC has a vast array of kind of means at its disposal to impose costs on Taiwan, right? And I think that this effectively kind of deters from Taiwan from doing something dramatic like declaring independence, right? But the PRC also kind of worries about kind of more subtle things like political, social trends in Taiwan, kind of trends in Taiwan-U.S. relations that PRC analysts kind of worry are having the effect of making unification something that's basically becoming impossible over the long term, right? So the PRC worries about political trends like the nationalists being marginalized politically in Taiwan. And the DPP has done very well in recent elections, right? And the nationalists have not. And so that's something that worries the PRC. Socially, if you look at public opinion polls in Taiwan, there's not much support for unification, even as kind of a long-term aspirational goal, and virtually no interest in unification as a kind of a near-term goal in Taiwan. And fewer and fewer people in Taiwan kind of think of themselves as Chinese, right? So public opinion polls increasingly reveal that people kind of think of themselves first and foremost as Taiwanese. And often in the past, people tended to have kind of this dual identity of Chinese and Taiwanese in these polls. And increasingly, they tend to solely identify in recent years as Taiwanese. And so these are worrying trends from the PRC perspective. And the PRC also worries about kind of growing U.S.-Taiwan security relations, or tightening relations, right? So the U.S. has kind of made a number of high-profile arms packages available to Taiwan in recent years. The U.S. has begun kind of announcing high-profile patrols through the Taiwan Strait and things like this. High-profile visits to Taiwan by, high-ranking current and former officials. So the PRC, I think, also worries that rapidly strengthening U.S.-Taiwan security ties potentially make unification as a plausible long-term outcome in the cross-strait relationship less likely. There's another scenario that's kind of grounded in pessimism in Beijing about where things are going in the Taiwan Strait and kind of the feasibility of unification even as kind of a longer-term endeavor.
So if we were so unlucky to have a war in the Taiwan Strait, starting, for instance, then with China trying to occupy Taiwan, this scenario, you say, is very likely. But what would the consequences be if this were to happen to Taiwan, China, and globally? Because it will have a signalizing effect, I guess, for globally, and especially for the United States, but of course also for the West and for the region also. So how would that be spelled out, do you think, if that would...
Yeah, I mean, the consequences, a lot of it would depend on kind of how a war played out, of course. But I think it's reasonable to expect that the potential consequences would be quite, scary, essentially, right? So if for Taiwan, especially, right, if Taiwan came under attack, it's very vulnerable to PRC missile and airstrikes, right? So there could be significant loss of life. And in a worst-case scenario, if Taiwan were to be occupied, it would likely lose its democracy, And so certainly the costs to Taiwan are most dramatic in a war scenario. But China also potentially, you know, faces huge risk, right, in a cross-strait conflict. There's the possibility that things don't go smoothly, and you see this with the Russian invasion of Ukraine, right? The assumptions are often, you know, turn out to be too rosy and so forth. And so I think there's certainly the potential for significant loss of life in China as well. And if the U.S. were to become involved, there's the risk of dangerous escalation with, you know, a nuclear superpower. China, of course, has nuclear weapons as well, right? And so that's a scary proposition, two nuclear powers potentially fighting each other directly, which is a very real possibility in a cross-strait war. And even if the U.S. doesn't become militarily involved, there's the possibility of an attempt to kind of mobilize international support for sanctions against China, which, again, could be quite costly to a regime that is quite integrated into global markets. And so there's significant, you know, potential costs for China as well. And globally, you know, the huge number of supply chains run through China, right? And so we're talking about kind of inflationary pressures as a consequence of this war in Ukraine. I think those are nothing compared to what would happen with the war in the Taiwan Strait.
Yes, if you're comparing these two situations, really, with the Ukraine, I mean, the war there and what's happened, I mean, for sanctions and everything, and also, of course, with resources and hindering Russia. But Russia's economy is nothing like the Chinese.
It's like one tenth.
So what you're actually saying now is that if there was to be a conflict, a military conflict, and serious one in Taiwan Strait, those consequences would be much larger than what we see now, and they are large consequences in the Ukraine-Russian war, but it will be even worse.
I think so. I mean, you wouldn't have the, you know, obviously the fuel, like the I don't think it would have the same impact on oil because of the kind of the direct, you know, on energy maybe, or food, right? So these are things. But
you know, then you know the small chips, you need them for everything,
don't you? Yes, right. And Taiwan's the leading global producer of high-end semiconductors, right? And so you could imagine the types of shortages that would be in the offing if there were to be a major war in the Taiwan Strait that took the Taiwanese economy offline, essentially.
And also, I mean, no, you're not writing about this in your Nobel Symposium paper, but you see what happened with Hong Kong and being integrated into to China, which was, of course, a peaceful thing because it was an agreement that were coming to term. And you know, but then again, the development in Hong Kong, it hasn't really been like the Westerns thought it should be. But Taiwan has the benefit of being across water, so it's not connected directly to mainland, and it's also bigger than Hong Kong. But do you see any things in those two relations that could be? Chinese. What shall we say, Chinese experience with Hong Kong and how that has developed and what Taiwan could learn and what China could learn.
So I mean, another thing Taiwan has going for it, right, is that it would be doing its own negotiation and not, you know, with Hong Kong, it was the British, right, that were negotiating with China because it was a British colony. And so Hong Kong, you know, maybe its interests weren't as central to that, those negotiations. But yeah, there's certainly Taiwan looks very closely at what's happened in Hong Kong. The PRC kind of calls its model for Hong Kong one country, two systems, and this is the same name of the proposal that the PRC has offered Taiwan.
Yeah.
Right. And so the idea is, and PRC officials will emphasize, oh well, Taiwan will be very different. You know, one country, two systems will be contextualized to kind of the Taiwan situation, but. But at the end of the day, it's still the same basic idea as Taiwan's being promised autonomy within the context of a formally unified country. And it's hard for the PRC to make credible promises of autonomy. You know, Tibet is formally an autonomous region, right? Hong Kong formally has all this autonomy. And especially over the past few years, we've really seen That autonomy being eroded. And people in Taiwan take note of that.
Yeah, so the credibility is very low.
Yes, it's very difficult for the PRC as an authoritarian system to make credible promises of autonomy, right? And just as, you know, dissent and, you know, criticism of the PRC are viewed as, you know, of concern, right? And threats to the CCP's hold on power, right? Internally, certainly these sorts of things, if they were going on in Taiwan in the context of a unified China, would be viewed as threatening. And it's hard to imagine in a unified government, the central government, not interfering on some level in Taiwan politics.
Yeah, let's return now to to your talk at the Nobel Symposium, because you say something that might be productive here. You say there are things that leaders in Washington, Taipei, and Beijing can do to foster stability in this situation without walking away from their key interests in this dispute. What are they, and what are your proposals for all these three main players here, Washington, Taipei, and Beijing, saying US, Taiwan, and China?
Yeah, so I think that the key thing to kind of recognize here, right, is that this is a dispute that is really, for the foreseeable future, an intractable dispute, right? So the PRC is not going to give up its claims to Taiwan, right? This is something that has been PRC policy for more than seven decades. And it's something that the PRC has really invested an enormous amount of, you know, reputation into. I think it's widely, like on a sincere level, people believe that Taiwan is rightfully Chinese in mainland China. China's military modernization program has kind of, you know, has been undertaken in part with the Taiwan contingency in mind. And so it's not going to go away. And at the same time, you know, Taiwan is not going to magically, like one day, kind of think, "Oh, yeah, maybe unification is a good idea."
It's a good idea,
right? there's you know, overwhelming sentiment among Taiwan's population, kind of across the political spectrum, that you know, regardless of kind of what you think about unification as kind of an aspirational long-term goal, that unification with the PRC is not a good idea, right? Because it's not viewed as kind of a credible regime, right? And so this is a dispute that's not going to go away, and it's really not one that is going to, you know, can be resolved in terms of kind of, you know, finding some sort of win set that's going to make everyone happy. And so I think that what leaders in Washington, Taipei, and Beijing need to do to kind of avoid worst case scenarios is they need to ultimately be somewhat pragmatic, right? And that means kind of recognizing that they're not going to get everything that they want. Right, but you know, and they need to kind of try to kind of reassure the other side. So in Washington, I think what this means is, on the one hand, yes, deterrence is really important, right? And it's important to invest in capabilities and help Taiwan invest in capabilities that help to deter a PRC military attack against Taiwan. But it's also important to reassure Beijing that the U.S. Does not support Taiwan's permanent separation from China, that it doesn't support Taiwan independence. And for instance, the United States should not change its longstanding One China policy, right, where it recognizes the PRC as the sole legitimate government or the sole legal government of China, and kind of takes an ambiguous stance on Taiwan's position within China. And so there have been calls in Washington to do away with this policy and to make stronger, more explicit commitments to Taiwan. And some, like Mike Pompeo, former Secretary of State, actually was in Taiwan recently giving a speech where he advocated formal recognition of the Taiwan government. And so I think these are things that feed into PRC fears about Taiwan's permanent separation from China and are a bad idea for that reason. And so Washington should be kind of pragmatic in this regard, strengthening deterrence, but also reassuring and not changing kind of fundamental, longstanding U.S. policy toward Taiwan. But I also think there needs to be reassurance in Beijing on some level, which you haven't seen, right? So the current government in Taiwan, even though it's Democratic Progressive Party, and you know Tsai is from the DPP, I think she's widely seen as being quite pragmatic. So she hasn't done something dramatic like declaring independence, right? She hasn't changed the, you know, done away with the ROC constitution, right? And she's kind of hinted that she kind of accepts kind of the broad constitutional order of the Republic of China, right? But the PRC hasn't been willing to speak with her. And I think that sends a bad signal to a party that is likely to remain a dominant force, you know, if not the dominant, like a major force in Taiwan politics kind of for the indefinite future. It kind of signals to aspiring leaders of the Democratic Progressive Party that, you know, being moderate in your approach to Beijing doesn't get rewarded with anything, even dialogue, right? It just gets rewarded with coercion, unless you basically go all the way and endorse kind of a one China principle, which is anathema to the base of the Democratic Progressive Party. And so I do think that ideally we'd see some more pragmatism coming from Beijing and at least some toning down of the coercion against governments that represent the deep, or where you have kind of DPP governments who, you know, while not maybe embracing a one China principle, are still being pretty pragmatic and aren't doing kind of major things to kind of formalize Taiwan's separation from China. And Taiwan, you know, again, I think, you know, embracing kind of some level of moderation, so not doing things like, you know, major policy shifts that kind of suggest Taiwan's formal separation from China.
I think what you are describing is actually a great deal of pragmatism on all parts.
Yes.
And also trying to not necessarily keeping status quo, but at least seeing that the situation that you have, you probably have to live with that for a long time. And that's probably, for the time being, the best situation that you could be in.
Yes, that's kind of how I see it.
That's okay. and then finally, how important is it to Southeast Asia and the more general and more generally to the world politics that Taiwan remains what we might say a liberal democracy? As you just stated in our conversation here, the Taiwanese see themselves now as more like Taiwanese themselves, mm-hmm. and probably also will adhere to liberal democracy. They have elections, they have different political parties and so forth. So, but how important is that as a signal to the rest of Southeast Asia that Taiwan remains a liberal democracy?
I think it's important. I mean, you know, we kind of live in a time right now where there's been a lot of democratic reversals, right? In the region and places like the Philippines, you know, or Myanmar kind of more dramatically. And, you know, but even in the West, right, in places like the United States, obviously, and parts of Eastern Europe. And so I think that Taiwan really kind of, stands as a contrast to some of these broader trends, right? We've seen this dramatic liberalization in Taiwan over the past several decades, right, where we went from as recently as 1987, martial law, right, and a suspended constitution to, you know, robust and vibrant multi-party democracy in more recent decades. And so I think it is important just because it kind of stands as a contrast to some of the broader trends that we've seen both regionally and globally in recent years.
How resilient do you think the liberal democracy and the institutions that the Taiwanese have built up, how resilient are they? And how, I mean, we know from experience that building a liberal democracy is not easy because you have to have all the things in place and you need to work on them. So how do you see, just a little insight, are you impressed by the Taiwanese or what do you think about them?
I'm very impressed by Taiwan. I think it's a very, it's quite a liberal. You know, I think Freedom House gives Taiwan, you know, a higher score these days than the United States in terms of. But I'm not positive about that, but it's. I think it probably does, right? The United States has been going
so it's
the wrong
impressive.
Direction. It is impressive. But politics is pretty nasty in Taiwan too, right? Like in a lot of places, and so I think that, you know, it's polarized and you have. These kind of charges of Chinese kind of meddling in Taiwanese elections and so forth. And so I think it's something that can't be taken for granted, right? Mm-hmm. And we see this elsewhere, right? Democratic resiliency is not something that you can take for granted. And it's something that it really needs to be kind of fought for continuously.
Very good. We'll just have to keep our fingers crossed then. And also... very much thank you for coming today, Scott. This has been a pleasure.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. Yeah, I enjoyed it.
And also, good luck with your Nobel Symposium speech.
Great, thank you.
If you like Liberal Haltime, rate us and recommend us or give us feedback using matilda@civita.no or my colleague eirik@civita.no. Information about Civita is available on our homepage, www.civita.no. Thanks for listening and welcome back.
Liberal Halvtime, en podcast fra tankesmien Civita.
Moderne medier.